Welcome to The Cherry Picker, the horror movie podcast where we like to kill people, but not really. I'm your host, Zach Cherry, and with me as always is...
An hour or less.
Eddie of Edward is Truth.
And today we're talking about Psycho.
Yeah, we are.
The seminal classic from Alfred Hitchcock, released August 17th, 1960. This is the oldest movie we've discussed on the podcast so far.
Yay! Yeah. And it's one of my... Like, to distill it down to a favorite, what your favorite horror movie is, when asked, this is my favorite horror movie.
This is your this is your absolute favorite. Okay.
I mean, I don't have... Because I don't really have one, but it's like, well, I'd just as soon have this one be my favorite. It definitely is, like, my top five, my top ten, but, you know, rankings...
I'd say that, yeah, I would put this in a top ten, for sure. I think this is a five-star out of five-star movie, for sure.
I adore it.
I can't find any... faults in it whatsoever, so I'm interested to hear yours.
Ooh, wonderful. No, I mean, it's because the thing is, like, it's not even like a movie at this point. It's more like visiting an old friend and just catching up. But because it's a movie, I've heard all the stories, so I just have to kind of like see it when I'm in the mood to just kind of hear that story again. You know?
Oh well, you'll have to share some of those stories while we go through this. But I wanted to say, like, every time I put this on and watch it, it does feel like it's there's a familiarity about it that I just, like, I know I'm in for a good time every time I put this on, that I could never be bored of watching this. If someone's just like, let's watch Psycho, I'd just be like, I just watched that 2 days ago, but yeah, let's put it on.
I could totally watch it right now, and I just did watch it two nights ago. It was, we've had such a heat wave in Los Angeles, and I guess all over California, basically, for such a long time, and it just broke a couple nights ago, and it started to rain, and I was driving home from my day job in the rain. I got to come home, and I got to carve out a little space for myself, and I got to watch it with the rain. This is a great rainy night movie. So the fact that I got to do that,
were you sitting in your your car just like pretending that you were Marion Crane driving through the storm looking for the Bates Motel?
No,
blinding headlights.
No, I mean, I was weary enough. Like, I probably should have. I wasn't even thinking about that, though. I was thinking too much about the stress of the week. But I was very Marion Crane. But I will tell you something that I've never told. I've only ever told one person this before, and it was behind closed doors. So I will tell you this on a podcast. Now everyone will know. I have a habit when I'm staying in a hotel and I have to unwrap the new soap, you know, to take my shower and everything.
Yeah.
I do what Janet Leigh does, which is kind of sigh and purse my lips while I unwrap the soap. She just kind of does this little... with these pursed lips while she unwraps the soap. And I can't not do it every time I unwrap. Sometimes even just new soap at my home, you know, but like, because you have to do it in the shower. And, oh, it just, it gives me, this movie courses through my veins. I've said that about many of the movies that we've discussed on the pod here, but this one might have occupied space in me. I think the only one that we've covered that's longer, that it's been with me longer, is probably The Thing. Because I did see it when I was a little bit older. I didn't see it when I was, you know, like 6 or 7.
Psycho then?
It was like 9 or 10. And I remember...
Well, give me a year, because we don't know. We don't know what year that is.
You want to try and find out how old I am? No, I'd say it all the time.
I'm pretty sure.
I would say probably like 1989. Maybe even earlier, though. Maybe it was 88 or 87. Okay. That actually feels more right.
So all of the sequels were still coming out at that time?
No. I'm not that old, but we had them on VHS and I did get to watch them, but I actually, even though we had them, I didn't watch the sequels for maybe about 5 years. I just loved the first movie. It never occurred to me to watch the sequels for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Even though we had them, that's so strange to me. That but, is. But I remember experiencing the movie before I saw the movie by going on the Universal Studios Hollywood tram ride. You go; it just takes you on a tour, and the Psycho House and the Bates Motel
set was
still set up. Yeah, I mean, it's on.
It's still there, right?
Oh yes, yeah. They use it now as kind of like the entryway for the Terror Tram when they do Halloween Horror Nights, and you actually get to take the tram. It gets parked kind of like catty-cornered from the Bates Motel, and basically you exit the tram. Usually it's clowns or aliens or whatever it is chasing you with chainsaws to the Bates Motel area, and you walk alongside it, and there's usually people being killed. It's not psycho-themed. It's usually whatever they've decided to theme the entire tram experience that particular year. But like 1 year when Scriforum was in theaters, it was like it was like the teenagers from Scriforum were celebrating some kind of like party at the Bates Motel. They were all getting slaughtered by Ghostface at the Bates Motel. It was very strange. It was surreal.
And but can are there tours that you can actually go inside the house?
I mean, not exactly. You can walk up on the steps and take photos for sure. But the thing is, that house is not a practical set, meaning it doesn't actually have the house inside. It's a front. It's a complete facade.
Okay.
Even though it's 360 degrees built, they only have enough like rigged for like the rocking chair to be positioned on for Mother to rock back and forth in that second floor window. But there's not like a big grand staircase or anything like that.
So the inside of the house was shot
on a soundstage.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And isn't there's a different house, because I from what I understand, the house in Psycho 4 is the one that's in Florida.
See, we're dipping into the sequels, and I didn't prepare for
that. Well, okay. But I was just asking about the house, not the movie.
Yeah. No, the house. That I can't remember. I feel like there might be some truth to that. I mean, there's so many psycho houses now too. I mean, there's the psycho house that was up north when they were shooting Bates Motel, that series that has its own location and everything like that. I'm trying to remember if the house. Yeah, I can't answer that question right now. I'm not prepared. Sorry.
Okay, well, that's totally fine. You know, just be skip.
Yeah, no, the old. We'll stick with the first movie.
Yeah. Well, because I first saw this, you know, I'm kind of embarrassed to say I don't remember when I first saw this.
Oh.
I know that I saw the remake, and I don't want to say that I saw the remake before the original. So I think that what must have happened is that I knew about the remake coming out, and I probably went to, you know, the local convenience store that rented out VHS movies and just rented Psycho from there. Which would have been like 1998 when the remake came out, just so I could see the original before I went to see the remake.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I'd seen it many times since, because I know that, when my mom got married, her partner had Psycho on VHS. So I watched it all the time that way. So yeah, it's, I think back then, just because, you know, I was a lot younger, it didn't really, you know, have like a huge effect on me, because I was probably more so like Michael Myers and Ghostface and all that. But, you know, I could always recognize there's something special about it. And, you know, when you take into consideration, this is a movie that came out in 1960, and you could just imagine, like, I wish that I could go back in a time machine and experience the movie for the first time with an audience in 1960, because I can only imagine that, you know, when you see movies today, when you go to the theater and whatever it might be, you know, there's people who are freaking out over the stupidest thing. Because, you know, I don't get terribly scared by things, as I've said many times. Yeah. But even watching it last night in the scene when she's in the shower and you can see through the curtain, like the door open up, I could just imagine the screams of terror in an audience of just seeing that door Krieg open, and then of course the silhouette of Mother coming towards the shower and that whole bit. So you know, it's that's a thing. Like you always have to take into consideration like the movie for its time. And I think that, you know, if Psycho, like, I don't know what the equivalent would be today. I really don't think there would be an equivalent, but you can just imagine that Psycho would have been like the scariest movie ever made at its time until probably something like The Exorcist came out, which was 13 years later.
I mean, it's also just in terms of the trend that it set, because once it was released, there were so many other movies that were either trying to replicate what it did or were even just kind of like using the fact that like, oh, we didn't know we could do that, so now we'll do that. But before we go into that, do you want a synopsis at all?
I was just going to ask you, because apparently we forgot last week. before we, before bodies. So before we get too ahead of ourselves, what, pray tell, is Psycho about, Edward?
After a Friday afternoon tryst in a Phoenix hotel with her boyfriend Sam Loomis, Marion Crane returns to work, dismayed at her inability to marry Sam because of his debts. In a moment of madness, Marion steals the $40,000 in cash that was entrusted to her for immediate deposit, setting off instead for Sam's home in Fairvale, California. After hurriedly trading in her car, arousing suspicion from both the car dealer and a patrol officer, Marion stops off the stormy main highway at the Bates Motel, where she joins the proprietor, Norman Bates, in a late-night sandwich and some conversation, during which Marion privately resolves to drive back to Phoenix in the morning and return the stolen money. As Marion showers, a shadowy figure in a dress appears and stabs her to death. But among the handful of people who trail Marion's whereabouts, who will survive long enough to discover the identity of the Psycho?
There needs to be like who will be left and what will be left of them.
Who will survive and what will be left of them? Now that's another movie, but no. But I think that, just in terms of like, this was, I think, probably the most successful movie up until that point that took place in a world that you and I, if we had we been alive at that time, could touch. You know, before then, you think about what horror movies were, what horror was doing in May. I'd say easily like at least the three decades prior. And it was usually, if it wasn't a large, dark castle, it was usually a large, dark mansion. And even though this is a very elaborate Victorian gingerbread style house, it always looked like a dollhouse sitting on top of the mountain, Norman Bates house. But it's still... It still connects, or it's just connected enough to the world. Like anyone who gets lost off of the major highway is going to find their way to a world like that. That is a little cut off, a little off the beaten path, and with people who are maybe couldn't exist in Fairvale. You know, they need to exist off what used to be the main highway. Yeah. You know. So there's something about that. And even there's so much, I won't linger on it because there's so much discussion surrounding the psychology of like the invasion of the shower and the sanctity of like just, you know, a very pedestrian setting for where people would never expect to be.
Well, I mean, like, you know, you're going to go wherever you're going to go with this podcast. But, you know, I was going to say, because, you know, I'm pretty sure we've talked about this before, but Psycho was kind of like... It's almost like the first in line of, like, if you can track the ancestry of, like, the horror movies that did redefine the genre. And, you know, and it's funny because they're all linked by a character named Loomis. So you've got Psycho, and then Halloween, and then Scream. And all of those, like, pretty much, they're all 18 years apart. So what came 18 years after Scream? I'm trying to think of if something came out that would have been...
That's 2006 and 2014? I guess 2014,
yeah.
I'm drawing a blank. Yeah. You tell me.
But regardless, like, I think that those were the movies that really redefined where the genre went for at least, like, the next decade after that. So that's, you know, that's why Psycho is so important to me.
Yeah, you know what? Sorry, just to hit on the 2014 thing, because I'm just looking at the movies I've collected that were released in 2014. Because of course I shelved them chronologically, so they're all like crunched together.
Yeah, you do.
But it's not one movie, but there is a sense of kind of like a new era in horror starting here, because I've got two major ones: The Babadook and A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which are both foreign and are both kind of like. I don't know. I feel like indicative of where the A24 indie, you know, art house feel that we were discussing in the past. Just a little bit closer to that. So maybe the trend isn't so much marked with a single film as it is with
a collection
of like what people were looking for. Because then the next year was The Witch. Mm-hmm. But anyway, with this one, I think also it helped that Hitchcock was as big of a star as he was already, not just as a film director, but Alfred Hitchcock Presents had been a hit on television for a while. And he was so recognizable that people even started, he loved to do his little cameos in films. At first, it started as just like a financial thing. There weren't enough extras to put in like his silent movies and, you know, things like that. So there would have to be a crowd. He'd have to stand there. But then people started recognizing him because he was so distinctive looking and so, you know, large.
It's almost like the horror Where's Waldo.
Yes,
and in this one, he appears at the beginning of the film as the man standing outside of Marion's office when she
with the cowboy hat.
Yeah, when she comes in late from her lunch break.
Yes,
and as far as I understand, because this movie was also made for very cheap, and he accomplished that because. He did use the film crew from the television show.
Shamley Productions. Yeah, that's what they were called.
Shamley.
And Shamley. But
is that like a spin on family? But just like
I know it wasn't spelled like that. Like a sham family. No. I don't know if I mean, his daughter Pat Hitchcock still she's not around anymore, but like on into you know, like the last years of her life, she still spoke very favorably about him. So I don't think there was a
and
family.
She played the other secretary.
Secretary, yes, yeah. She was. If I remember distinctly one particular Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode that she was in, but I think she did a couple. And she is a hoot. Anytime you can see an interview with her, she's just very outspoken. Seems like a great gal. And she actually, I laughed out loud at a moment. I don't remember laughing out loud before at. I always remember the line that she delivers when the creepy guy in the cowboy hat is leaning over Marion and flirting with her and telling her she needs a weekend in Las Vegas or whatever. And he says, sometimes I can't keep my mouth shut. And then she's like, and he walks away. And then little Pat Hitchcock wanders over and goes, he was flirting with you. I guess he must have seen my wedding ring. But what I love
is
immediately after that. Yeah, immediately after that moment, though, because she takes the money and she's looking at the money and Marion takes the money back from her and she kind of makes this little frown face like, oh, well, Oh, and Marianne just kind of, it's just Janet Leigh. It looks like Janet Leigh just smiling at Pat Hitchcock, like, you're so silly, and just putting the money back in the envelope. I don't know. It's just like wonderful little moments like that. I'm still discovering things when I watch this movie. And
well, doesn't she still, like fan herself with the money? Like when she's just like flipping through it?
I don't know if she fans herself. That's a little like, ooh, I wonder what's going to happen with this. I think she's, but she is like, flipping it.
Just maybe that was like the remake.
Yeah, maybe it was Rita Wilson. Oh, God, the remake. God, there are so many. I can't help but think about the remake every now and then when I watch the movie now. Yeah. And it's not for the better. But it does make me appreciate this.
Maybe at some point in the future we'll cover the remake. But all I can say about the remake is that like I always forget how bad it is. Because I'm just like, how bad can it be? It's just the same thing. But it's not. It's not. It's terrible. And I always just like come out of that being like, why? Like,
yeah. What's
the point? But
I mean, yeah, we should do a pod on that because I do have a lot of opinions on it, and also a lot of opinions on like, or I wouldn't call them insights, but just observations about some choices they made design wise and things like that that I that would be fun to talk about.
Yeah, totally.
But with this one, like you were saying, Alfred Hitchcock wanted to make this. The goal was to make a movie for under $1 million because he was seeing so many films in the horror genre make all the money that weren't terribly good and that were not terribly expensive to make. And he was like, well, what if I... And the legend that Joseph Stefano, the screenwriter, says is that that's what motivated him. He wanted to, just as an experiment, see, like, what if somebody good worked with a budget like, you know, The Amazing Colossal Man or something like that. And... I believe, though, at that point, he was so famous and so beloved, and he had just done North by Northwest, which was such a huge hit and such a big... So many of his movies were big, illustrious, Technicolor, starring Cary Grant or James Stewart and, you know, inevitably some beautiful blonde actress, you know? Just take your pick. But I feel like something that might have been motivating him to make Psycho, and this is just purely an opinion. I haven't based this on any like actual research. It's just a feeling I get. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's made by a man who wants to fall in love with filmmaking again, who just doesn't want the droves of people on a soundstage, and doesn't want the heights of production. Who just kind of wants to do something simple, almost like it's on a student film level, you know, but still work with people he respects, who he feels like he can rely on, but just to have fun doing it. Because another thing, he was notorious for kind of like having somewhat testy relationships with his actors, because he was quoted as saying actors should be treated as cattle. And the thing is, all of the interviews I've seen with Anthony Perkins, Janet Leigh, and Martin Balsam in particular in this movie, they have nothing but gracious praise for the man, for working with him, and for his interactivity with them and his innovation, like allowing them to discuss moments and dissect them and try different things different ways. And I believe Tony Perkins even talked with him about the storyboards of the scene between he and Martin Balsam in the hotel, in the front office when he's signing him in and everything, and they get that shot underneath Tony Perkins' chin.
The way he kind of leans in sideways.
Yeah, well, he's chewing the candy corn and everything like that to accentuate the chicken-like neck, you know? Because birds. But, but I mean... Because they had tried some, I think they had shot it one way with the storyboards, and Tony Perkins and Martin Balsam had an idea, and they shared it with Hitchcock. He was like, okay, let's try shooting it that way too. Something that was kind of unheard of by the legend that had kind of grown up around Alfred Hitchcock. But I think he was kind of sick of the legend at this point and wanted to, like I say, fall in love with movie making again. Yeah. Because that's the feeling I get when I watch it. You feel like someone who must love filmmaking put this together.
Yeah.
And I feel like that from everyone who contributes, from the costuming to Bernard Herrmann with the score to the design to the cinematography, every aspect of it. I don't feel like there is a weak link necessarily in this movie.
Yeah. I think, like, another thing that should be taken into consideration is that if a director is kind of larger than life, like, they have a reputation that precedes them, there's probably a reason for that, and it's probably not because they were an asshole during their filming production. So if there is kind of, like, this narrative behind a director, or Hitchcock in this case, of just, you know, quoting, saying that, oh, it's like, you know, cattle. Like, that just might be, like, his sense of humor. But the thing is, like, when you have, like, big-name directors like this, like, I can only imagine that as an actor, which I'm not, but, like, for anyone who is an actor, it would probably be, like, the opportunity of a lifetime to work on a movie with one of these directors, you know, whether that is Hitchcock or John Carpenter or Wes Craven, because you're really, like, seeing, like, a master at their craft putting something together. So if they're telling you, like, you know, I need to herd you over here now so I can do this, like, you're just like, wow, okay. You know, you're not gonna be like, could you say that a little nicer? I didn't like
it. No. Also, I think there's a type of actor, because I've worked with that person. I remember standing alongside a woman once who wanted to stop rehearsal because she had a question about her character. Mm. And that's not something you stop the director mid-sentence while he or she is addressing a room full of people to ask about. And when he tried to communicate this to her, she was like, but I have a question for you about my character! And I was like, oh my goodness, is this going to turn into something? So, there's that kind of actor. But one thing that I love watching Janet Leigh speak to it, everything you're saying is basically reiterated like that from her, because she heard about the offer to play the role, and there was no script yet. Joseph Stefano hadn't been hired yet, but Hitch knew that he wanted to do it, so he sent her the small Robert Bloch novel, which I just happen to have right here for people who are watching, and read it probably 4 or 5 times already. And good book. But she read it too, and he just said, please consider the role of Mary. And she was like, well, I didn't even need to read it because I wanted to work with Hitchcock, but I did because he told me to. And she, the thing that made her want to do it was, aside from just like the idea of working with him on a project, she wanted to see, how is he going to turn this? Because it was very exploitational and very, very sensational. Like, you know, it's just, and it's very much about kind of like the dregs of humanity. The book is more so than the movie. The movie brings glamour. The movie brings, even I would say, a weird accessibility, like a personability, like Hitchcock and Joseph Stefano and everybody else concerned seem much more concerned with putting you in the position of someone who would make these decisions, and putting it, like, so you can see it through their lens so you don't judge them. Mm-hmm. The book doesn't really do that. The book's Norman Bates is, from the very beginning, like, he's an alcoholic, he's very bitter. That exchange with Mary in the book is nothing like the exchange in the office in the movie. Like, there's such peace. It's one of my favorite pieces of cinema. It's just the scene in the parlor. And when you read the book, the entire time Mary is just incredibly uncomfortable. And all she can think is, this bitter ass man, God, I can't go this way. I don't want to end up like this guy. So I'd better go take a shower and go home, kind of thing. But, and instead, in the movie, it ends up feeling like there's this incredible synthesis, this, like, almost like a transition of souls between the two. Like, he does make her uncomfortable, but not to the point where she's turned off and needs to excuse herself. It's to the point where he's talking about something real, and then he hits on subject matter that speaks directly to her immediate situation at that particular moment, about being trapped and about being kind of like a slave to your predicament. When he starts defending his mother and all of that, I just love the fact that, like, he says, we all go a little mad sometimes, smiles at her and says, haven't you? And she's like, yes. Yeah.
There's a lot of parallels between Mary and Norman, actually. But what's, and I, was just sort of like watching the beginning of the documentary that followed the movie on the 4K.
Oh, yes.
I was watching it. And I mm-hmm. was, I don't know, how, this must have been filmed in the 90s. It looked pretty old. But yeah, it was an interview with Joseph Stefano. And he actually said that, because the story in the book is so much different than the screenplay that they made, that they just kind of used it. Like, the book was almost more like Ed Gein territory. And that's why that everyone says, like, oh, this movie's based on Ed Gein, and this movie's based on Ed Gein. It's just like, really? Sure. Like, how? But I guess, like, the story was more of, like, an Ed Gein type character, like this, you know, notorious real-life serial killer. And the decision, like, because Joseph Stefano wasn't the first screenwriter that was hired. They had
No.
And yes. Hitchcock did not like their version of Psycho, because I guess that was more in line with what the book was. And when Joseph Stefano came aboard, that was his decision to frame the movie from Marion's perspective. It was going to be her movie. We were going to start with her movie and then get to the motel, where then she would be murdered, and then the real movie would unveil itself of what it actually was. And that's where, like, Hitchcock immediately was like, yes, I know what this is, and I need a big-name actress for that role. So I only bring that up because you said that he had already come to her before they had a story. So
before they had a script. Before they had a script. She didn't have a screenplay to... Yeah, she didn't have a screenplay to read to consider the role, so he had to send her the book.
Okay.
Joseph Stefano was already working on it, but you know, they needed to to air it out. He needed to do a first draft, a second draft, and everything like that. And interestingly enough, yeah, the thing is also what the criticism for the first script. I forget the screenwriter who they hired. He was a writer for some of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes, though. I know that. The criticism was that it was dull, and so it's like, and I don't know how with I'm going to keep picking up the book, but I don't know how you take this book and write something boring out of it. And also, oddly enough, the book starts as Mary's story, the same way the movie does. So I feel like Joseph Stefano probably read the book and just kind of thought, well, why wouldn't I do what Robert Bloch did? Why wouldn't I make the movie about her? Because maybe I'm wondering if the original screenwriter might have started at the hotel or something and made the story about... I have no idea. I have no idea. If there's a first draft available somewhere, I'd love to get my hands
on it. And I think that, like, obviously that's the best decision to go with this movie, because, like, as I watch it, like, you know, just talking about, like, you know, being in for, like, a fun ride and just, like, having that, that familiarity, because there's something so... Like, the pace of the movie is so good. It's like, even considering, like, long 10-minute scenes of him just, like, covering up the crime scene and all that. But it's just because the story is constantly moving. There are no lulls for me. And the fact that, you know, it does kind of do the whole transition at the halfway mark. And I think this was actually mentioned in X that came out this year, because they referenced Psycho and specifically referenced the idea of MacGuffin. And I mean, not that I think that, like, you know, looking back on X, I don't think that there was really, like, a MacGuffin, like a Psycho MacGuffin per se. But
not that I can remember.
Yeah, because it was, like, seemed a little more straightforward, but, like, definitely with Psycho, because a MacGuffin can be so many different things. And I think in this case, it's an event. Because that would be her stealing the money and going off to this motel in the middle of nowhere. And that in itself, like, what's so great about Psycho is, like, that's such an, like, interesting story. Like, even if the remainder of Psycho didn't happen, I still want to see the rest of Marion Crane's story, you know?
Right, the, like, fact if she that, made like, it.
No, but, the, like, what makes it so successful is that, like, you have this story, but then you replace it with an even more interesting story, and that's how you properly do a MacGuffin. And that's why, you know, the movie works as well as it does. And if that was in the book, you know, that's would have been whoever the author is of the original book, like, you know,
Robert Bloch.
Yeah, he knew what he was doing, so Joseph Stefano recognized that as well. And that's why, you know, if you compare it to the first script of whatever the one writer did, if, like, why it was dull, because, you know, he was picked like the completely wrong entry point to go in and probably missed out on all the nuance of what made Psycho, because if Psycho really did just start with Norman Bates and like, you know, how we see it, you know, it might've been good. You know, if you have Anthony Perkins, you know, playing this role or whatnot, even though Anthony Perkins is so far removed from like what Norman Bates was in the novel, it still wouldn't be like, it wouldn't have the magic of that movie. You know, that's almost like Scream, if they just started Scream without having Drew Barrymore at the beginning of Scream.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. It sets a bar. I mean, granted, I think Wes Craven was a lot more economical with his use of Drew Barrymore in Scream. But Alfred Hitchcock was also the first to do this bait and switch that was echoed by John Carpenter, Wes Craven, Sean Cunningham, Wes Craven again, and countless others in, you know, lesser known films, and franchises. But the thing about, oh, you said so much. I just wanted to address like all of it, but it's great. Cause I get really excited when I talk about this movie. It's a campfire movie for me. But, one of the things that I adore about the MacGuffin, as it were, is the fact that also in the filmmaking of the movie, it keeps being reintroduced. Like people who are looking at for Marion and everything like that keep bringing it up. Like Arbogast comes in and he's just kind of like, you know, oh, somebody saw her. Somebody always sees a woman who's got $40,000, and he's trying to figure out what happened and like who found out about the money and why did they do it. And the same thing with Lila and Sam. When they finally go after her, they're like even finding that little clip of paper with $40,000 on it and thinking, oh my gosh, that proves he knows about the money. And even at the very end, when it's finally revealed, the men, or the room full of men and Lila, while they're having everything explained to them, one of the questions is, what about the $40,000? Who got that? And it's like, no, we're continually... Yeah, I know. These were crimes of passion, not profit. And I fucking love that, because crimes of passion, so much more interesting than crimes of profit for me. Crimes of profit are... they can be intriguing, but they're also very predictable. Crimes of Passion, you can't... anytime I've shown this movie, I've shown it to quite a few friends of mine when I find out that they have not seen it. Yeah. And it's just like, okay, I have to show it to you. Do you know anything about it? And they'll just be like, I just know, like, the shower scene, and that's all. I'm like, okay, don't talk to anybody. Don't ask me. When can you come over? I'm going to screen it for you, and I'm just going to watch you watch it. Sorry. and I love that... pretty much everybody before Norman carries mother down the steps in that bird's eye view shot, everybody usually guesses that Norman must be pretending to be his mother prior to that moment. And then when they see that, it always works on them. And I always hear like, wait a minute. So they're not the same person? Oh, so... what is going on? So she is crazy, you know, and then they get so frustrated, and I fucking love it, because I'm like, okay, it's all set up and it's going to pay off. In that moment, you're going to be as shocked that didn't occur
to you. Well, you made me realize something, because like the Marion story isn't really wrapped up. Like it does continue for, you know, the supporting characters of that story. And it's kind of like they're now transitioning into this new movie where they're now becoming the supporting characters of Norman's movie. But this is the thing, and we've talked about this before. It's frustrating when we as an audience are several steps ahead of the characters. And, you know, arguably you could say that with Psycho, we're several steps ahead of Sam and Lila and Arbogast because we know that they're chasing this lead of just like the 40,000. Cause that's, you know, that scene where Sam's in the office and just being like, oh yeah, if you had the money, you get out of here, you know, whatever. And the reason why it works here is because we know that, you know, we know that Norman has no idea that there ever was $40,000. Cause he just casually took the newspaper that was folded up with the money in it and threw it in the trunk. Ugh. It was almost just like, it was nothing to him. So the fact that
you thought the movie was going to be about this, it's not.
So the fact that they're still on that train, but we also have this new mystery. It's almost like we know something that you don't know, but we also don't know what that is. So that's where it makes it enjoyable to see them try to catch up, because you know that the only way that we're going to figure out, like, as an audience, of what the mystery is with Norman and his mother is for these characters to figure out that there is no $40,000. Like, forget it. So we need them to explore that to a point and take us to where we need to. So that's why that's why everything in this movie works perfectly. Because there is no wasted time. There is no moment of just like, come on, like pick up the pace here, get with the program. Like, this is the movie.
There was one scene that Joseph Stefano wrote that even he doesn't think ever got shot. But he can't remember because, you know, years ago. Mm-hmm. But he's talked about it. I actually got to see a Q&A with him some years back, maybe about 15 years ago, at Cal State Northridge out here in the San Fernando Valley. I used to go to the library there, and I was walking. Sorry, I've got like about 10 different topics going on. But I used to go to the library there just to kind of like read and settle and everything like that. And I would... And one day I was walking past this beam and it had a flyer on it with the Psycho House on it. So immediately my eye went, and it said Q&A with Joseph Stefano on date in this hall at this time. And I was like, oh my God. And it was, I think it was that weekend or something like that. And I went, even though I wasn't attending California State Northridge University, but, and sadly, I'm really, really sorry to report that I was one of three people there who was in attendance. I don't know if it was just there weren't enough flyers in the right places for enough people to see. Because for me, it was like the chance of a lifetime. I can watch Joseph Stefano speak. Oh my God, that's one of my favorite screenplays of all time.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were just three of us. And he still spoke. He still, you know, just kind of like addressed us. I was too... shy. I wouldn't be now, but I was too shy. I think it was like 20, maybe 19 or 20. And I was just like a little too shy to like speak up and ask questions for the Q&A. So I just sat, but I did take notes and I still have them somewhere. I just remember, but I remember him. He talked about the remake and that was fun. I can tell you about that in the remake pod. But he talked about working on this and like what was motivating him, and a lot of it does get covered in the documentary, the Making of Psycho documentary. But one of the things that that I loved that he addressed was just the fact that at a particular time there were people like film historians or whatever who kept at him, like a lot of different people kept coming at him in interviews trying to find out like there's any kind of like sexuality or any kind of, shall we say, sexual appetite be, or even just sexual change, you know, like within a character. I think in the late 90s and around 2000, like people just kind of wanted it to mean more than it did or mean something that it didn't. And so many people were asking him if Norman was gay, wanting the answer to be yes. And he would just say, no, having no problem disappointing them, no, he's not gay. If he were gay, he'd be killing men. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we also know there are two missing girls. So there are some other people probably down at the bottom of that swamp with Marion Crane. The only reason Arbogast gets killed is because he got too close.
I mean, how much of that do you think is because of Anthony Perkins, though?
I think a great deal of it. And also I think there were some things even at that point that I hadn't articulated to myself yet that might read as gay-coded or, again, like I said, like this was made in 1960 when anything that was kind of off the beaten path, which is straight cis gender, you know, heterosexuality, is gay or, you know, or at
least
depraved.
Well, there's a scene towards the end when Sam and Lila check in because they're posing as the married couple, but then, you know, he kind of wanders off while she goes up to the house and meets him in the office. And they're like, oh, I was hoping to have a conversation with you. And they're like, even watching him, like there's a part of this that does feel a little gay, but like not on Norman's part, more so just like Sam. And, like, maybe what he perceived of way, like, a way to distract Norman. I did first read that as just kind of, like, the wife's sleeping, you know? And I thought it would give us, you and I, a chance to talk. Because, like, why would you go talk, like, you're the only people at this motel. Why would you go talk to the only other like man there while your wife is
Yeah,
like it's just and it also, was very peculiar. And that scene, it never lingers on it because it's always cutting back to where's Lila going? Where's she at? So we're just kind of seeing, you know, the small bits, and he's like, oh, I feel like, you know, I'm doing all the talking here, and it's just, you know, normally when people are isolated by themselves, they're the ones that are talking. But you know, you can see that it's almost like Sam is like a really bad interrogator, and he's just like showing his hand way too soon, where he's just absolutely, like, you know, what would you do with like $40,000? And Norman's like, what the fuck are you even talking about?
Some place where you don't have to hide your mother. And all that. But even like, there is something weird, oddly kind of like predatory in a nature, like, because if I were standing across from a man who looked like John Gavin, who was saying like, so you've spent your whole life here, huh? Drive me crazy. While he's not losing eye contact with me, I'd probably be like, oh, well, really? I mean,
all we needed was
lots of ways to.
We needed Pat Hitchcock to make another appearance where she's just like, I think he's flirting with you.
That would have been
her thing. She'd just pop out of the parlor and then like...
Yeah, right.
Where'd she come
from? He's flirting with you. With her like quasi-English-American accent. I love it. But yeah, that'd be great. But also the sense that I think there's something to it that I used to identify with Norman before I kind of defined my own sexuality to myself, and I won't delve into that, but I'll just say, I remember, you know, I felt different than the other boys, and I remember I'd watch the movie, and a lot of what, like, I guess motivated Norman to be private in that he had a secret that he had to hide from everybody, like, any kind of dual character, any character who had any kind of duality for better or worse, I totally identified with, and Norman struck me as someone who'd understand, you know, like, I was young enough, like 8 or 9, to think like, I wish Norman Bates, this is so weird to think, but this is how safe I thought I could be with Norman Bates, because Norman Bates isn't mother. But I remember thinking like, I wish Norman Bates lived at the end of my street. So like, anytime I was bored or anytime I just needed to like get away from my house and my family or anything like that, which wasn't often, but if I did, I could just like go over and he'd probably have like games and he'd probably have, you know, he'd probably like give me his full attention and he'd probably be really, really nice to me and he'd probably share his candy with me and he'd probably be, I just got the sense that he was like this really, really nice guy, even though I knew the end of the movie, you know, I still thought, but as long as I don't upset mother, like, I'll be quiet, you know, like, whatever. And I think there's something else to it, though, that, like, what I was leading up to before is just, I always thought about that one shot of Norman going up the staircase before he carries mother down the stairs. And the camera follows him up the stairs, and there is the slightest little hip swivel going on. And I remember when I was young and ignorant, I attributed it to, well, because I think somehow I knew Anthony Perkins was gay at that point. And I remember thinking, or I'd heard of it, and I was just kind of like, oh, so he's gay, so he walks like that. And says the closeted child, you know, now, and for probably a couple decades now, I've watched it and I've seen, no, he's becoming mother. Like, there's that wonderful kind of like blurred line. It's not always going to be like, I'm Norman, I'm mother. You know, it's not going to be that. Sometimes there might be a progression. There might be a, you know, like, oh, I'm getting ready to be mother and everything like that, you know, like, I don't know. I just felt like there was this wonderful kind of amorphous thing going on, this shared identity. And that made it even more intriguing to me.
Interesting.
But I think that might have, again, like, been something that some film historian could have seen and thought, oh, he's gay because he walks with his hips like that.
I mean, I was mostly watching that shot. Like, that shot in and of itself is incredible, how it does follow him up the stairs, but then, like, lifts up to the ceiling and then turns around with this bird's eye view.
Yeah, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. Also, another thing that I love about the cinematography in this movie, I touched on it a little bit earlier just in terms of the movie overall, but I kept noting how many times the camera puts us in a POV to get us to empathize with the characters. Like, I noticed when Marion is at the car lot and she has to go into the restroom to unpack the money and she needs $700. And the camera, she very unnaturally, she doesn't hold it toward herself. She kind of holds it toward the camera, opens up the envelope, and counts seven. Like, the camera holds on it for the audience to sit there and count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, you've got the 700. You know, like, to just put you in her experience, because if you were to commit this crime, how would you be? There are moments that like that that are completely immersive. And then there are other moments that I didn't even realize were immersive as a kid. I used to think, as of when I was very, very young, I used to think Janet Leigh fell prey to the era of acting that she was in when she was so kind of like deer in headlights about talking to the cop. She's got that, and she doesn't really even blink. She just sits there and she just speaks so uncomfortably. And even as a kid, I remember thinking, like, I can lie better than that. Yeah. Like, come on, like, breathe. Like, you know, just act like, that's you know, whatever, and everything.
That's another parallel between Marion and Norman. Like, they
they're terrible liars
to save their life. And they just, like, they stumble upon lie after lie and just get in so deep to the point where they're just like, I want you to leave now because this is
exactly
good at this.
Or like, oh, you're not, or you're following me? Are you following me? But the thing is, what I love about the fact that they are such bad liars now, again, like, and for probably the last couple decades watching the movie, I've had this rediscovery where I'm like, oh no, she's supposed to be a bad thief, because as an audience, we're supposed to be going, no, 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 come on, be cool, be cool. Because it's putting us on her side. We're almost coaching her through those moments, being like, dude, just, it's fine. It's fine. Just breathe, just breathe, just breathe. Because if we're coaching her, then we want to see what's going to go on. And the filmmaking is working.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, because we have to empathize with these characters. And that's why, you know, if Norman was presented as the alcoholic, or, you know, what, I think he was even like,
he was older, he was overweight.
Yeah, like, it's just like, it would have been more difficult for the audience to get on board, especially since you're transferring that empathy now over from one character to another. So it is important that, you know, they share that quality about them that, you know, even if we're not consciously just being like, oh, that's, you know, exactly. Because I, you know, forgot about that as well. Just like the similarities there with the two characters when they're confronted with authority asking them questions.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
it's, you know, even though like we know both of them are doing bad and criminal things, we're still on their side. We're still, you know, we don't like that the cop. We don't like Arbogast. You know, we're rooting for the villains here to win. And I think that's a trademark of Hitchcock, because I haven't seen every Hitchcock movie, but I know that there's, you know, a lot of his films where, you know, we are in the vantage point of the villain, and we're, you know, wanting to see them succeed. So I think that's something that, you know, he did very successfully.
Yeah, and there's even there's moments of relief that we get to experience through the characters. Well, I think one of my favorites for Marion is when she starts driving away from the police officer for the first time after he stopped her. He didn't even stop her. He woke her up on the road.
Yeah.
And she's given him her papers. He's got the license plate for her Arizona car and everything, and she starts driving away.
No goodbye, and nothing.
No.
Gives the license back, takes off.
No, but she's just like driving away, and he starts following her, and we get that dun 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 dun. Ah, fucking amazing music. And she's looking, she's seeing the menace, you know, like in the rearview mirror, and we're seeing it through her perspective. And anybody who's ever been followed by a police officer understands, I think. Even in the before times when I didn't, you know certain things about, you know, like the origins of the police and stuff like that. Even just as a child, I remember thinking like, I remember realizing whenever I was around a police officer, I immediately felt guilty for nothing. You know, even if I'd done nothing wrong, I'd feel like, oh no, I better not do anything wrong or else they'll arrest me. And so something about like putting us in that position, but then also she's watching him follow her, follow her, follow her. And then he slowly drifts to an off ramp, and she almost misses it. And then she catches it. and has this wonderful moment of relief, like exhalation. And yeah. I always feel like my endorphins kick in at that moment because I know that feeling. And it, and again, puts us totally on our side. And with Norman, it's the swamp.
He was really, like, the officer was really giving me, I mean, I guess, like, reverse, though, Michael Myers vibes of just, because he was following. Because there is that shot where, you know, he's parked across the street and she keeps looking over and he's very centered to the frame. And he's standing in front of his cruiser. But it always reminds me, or I'm just, like, every time I see it, it reminds me of the shot, you know, when we do see in Halloween when Laurie... incidentally, Janet Leigh's daughter is looking out the window of the classroom, and there's Michael Myers standing behind the car. But it's you know, you could see that and be like, oh, John Carpenter took that from Psycho. Because that character, he is very, like, quiet and stoic. We don't get a lot, and he moves very slowly, too. When he's, like, when she's driving off, and the mechanic is just like... wait, your bags. And, you know, we just see him slowly. Like, if he really wanted to, like, catch up with her, he could have been like, wait a second. But he was just walking towards her with, like, the movement of Michael Myers in the original Halloween.
Or even of Mother Bates, like, behind the shower curtain, that slow kind of, like, step, step toward. I adore it. I'm just going to sit here and just be like, oh, God, lust.
Well, you also, you mentioned the music, which I feel like deserves, you know, accolades itself. Because, like, that's the first thing you hear, you know, when the credits come up. And that's part of the reason why, you know, like, you're in for, like, a fun time with this movie. Because it's just, it's so iconic and, like, playful, but also... not scary, but, you know, just you the strings, like, you just know, like, there's suspense and intrigue and mystery that's ahead of you. So I think that in terms of film scores, you know, and, you know, we see this kind of replicated by Harry Manfredini in Friday the 13th. So I think that this is probably, you know, like, thinking back to film scores, you know, definitely should be top five for sure.
Oh, those shower stings, the those were Brian De Palma was so enamored of them that he decided to make them the sound for when Carrie White, like, makes things move telekinetically, like, that every time you hear it, there's a it's a shower stab basically every time. She even does stab sometimes, like, with her telekinesis with it. But but I'm glad that you brought that up, because it made me think. I have AMC Plus right now, and it might be via Shudder, I don't know, but I rewatched a documentary that was released in 2017 prior to this, called 7852, and the shower scene. And it's just a bunch of filmmakers and actors and whatnot sitting there discussing the shower scene, but also the movie around it and things that lead up to it and the aftermath and all of that. And it's interesting if you just want to keep the conversation going. There are some things that I don't like about it, but one of the things that was brought up with reference to the music was, I can't remember if it was Daniel Noah, but the producer, who said that his daughter at one point went re to him, and she's never seen Psycho. So she doesn't even know what she's doing, but she's referencing Psycho. It's that, like, omnipresent. It's almost, there was a joke made between him and Elijah Wood that they're, like, we must kind of, like, now, kind of, like, it, from inception, like, kind of, like, and to birth, like, just kind of, like, somehow by osmosis, like, receive the knowledge. Oh, yes, the shower scene in Psycho, Bernard Herrmann. That's a knife. You know, I don't know, something like that. But, another thing that I love about the score is, much like you mentioned John Carpenter and Halloween and everything, Psycho, the first time Hitchcock screened it for Joseph Stefano, it was a rough cut. And so it wasn't, you know, like, timed the way it is now. And it was, and it had no music. And Joseph Stefano thought it was a terrible movie. And Alfred Hitchcock just kind of slapped his knee and said, it's just a rough cut, Joseph. So then he worked his magic and sat in the editing room and cut the frames. Hilton A. Green, one of the producers, said that he called Hitchcock a frame cutter, that he would literally know which frame needed to be cut at, you know, like with the physical film as they were editing, as they were splicing it and everything like that. So that was all done, and it was put together, and Joseph Stefano saw it, and it was all pasted, and he said it was beautiful, and it worked. Then he saw it with the Bernard Herrmann score, and he almost fell out of his seat. And it just made me think about, like, John Carpenter's Halloween. If you watch that movie without the music, you might not have such a great time. We even suggested some of those off-pod, that some of those sequels could have used some John Carpenter magic, you know, like, worked into some moments, yeah. Maybe to... punch
I mean,
up
well,
the,
like I mentioned
the
with the Halloween 2018 podcast, like that the only reason that movie is even slightly successful for me is because of John Carpenter's involvement. So it definitely helps, you know.
Yeah, and I can't imagine. It's so funny to like hear. I remember there's interviews with Peggy Robertson, Hitchcock's assistant at the time. She's this incredible. Around the time that the Making of Psycho documentary was made. She was this just wonderful elderly British woman who spoke with her chin up and almost through pursed lips the entire time. One of my favorite kind of people, you know? But she was sitting there talking about like how she'll talk about like how it was put together, things that seem like kind of like set in stone, that seem like all part of the Hitchcock plan. It's no different. Like filmmaking, no matter who you are, you can plan all you want for it, but you're going to discover things and you're going to need to change things as it evolves from the page to what you shoot on set or on location to what you edit in the room to what you screen before an audience. It's always going to be evolving. And there was one point where they were watching a particular cut. And Hitchcock said, I'm going to do my Peggy Robertson impression of Hitchcock, like said to Bernard Herrmann, like, Bernard, surely that wonderful shower scene, those fiddles going all up and down, should come back when Norman makes the entrance at the end with the knife at the young sister and everything to stab her and everything. Just all those fiddles going. Bring back the theme. And so he did. Because originally, Norman was just supposed to, I guess, run down the steps and just show up there smiling with
the
knife.
It does. The score does feel very sudden in that moment. Like, it almost felt like it was like a rough cut to put it back in there. I mean, it works, but it does stand out at first of just like, oh, you know, like you know what I mean, like the transition into it seemed a little harsh.
Well, that whole moment feels experimental to me, because also the original plan, while Tony Perkins is being held back by John Gavin and the dress opens up and the wig is coming off and he's doing that you know, that weird thing, it looks very strange. The original plan was for the mother's scream, which was, you know, voiceover. It was pre-recorded, recorded in post, actually. But the ADR lines of Mother. It was supposed to be Mother's scream the entire time. And I don't know how they came upon it. Maybe just like in the editing of it, the scream that they recorded wasn't long enough, and Hitch saw what it looked like with Tony Perkins just being held back by John Gavin after we'd heard the scream, but now just going... And he just so adored the strangeness of it that he thought, let's not put the scream in. That's perfect the way that is. It's strange. It's surreal. It's going to destroy the audience's mind. Let's do it. And it works, because I don't know what to make of what's going on in that moment. It's just madness. Yeah. And I love the expression on Lila Crane's face, because she doesn't know either. She's just, it's just a gasp. It is literally like a cinematic depiction of gasp. And I want to talk about Vera Miles a little bit, because she ended up showing up for me. We talked about her in our Final Girls after hour ranking and everything like that. And I wasn't that favorable. Yeah. No. I wasn't that favorable toward her. And watching the movie again, this is the first time I've seen it since that pod, because I didn't rewatch the movie for the pod, because I know it too well. Yeah. Or I thought I did. And while I was watching it, I was watching her performance, because I think I criticized her for being a little stoic, a little, you know, I don't know, lacking a little bit of verve and vigor. And I always attributed it to Hitchcock didn't spend all that much time, as interactive as he was and connected as he was to Tony Perkins, Janet Leigh, and Martin Balsam in their performances, he did not take that same time with Vera Miles and John Gavin. I think number one, he felt like they were characters that, who cares? These aren't the people we're watching. They care about the people we care about. That's why we're watching them. So do whatever you want. But also I know Vera Miles, had become pregnant prior to Vertigo, and so she couldn't do it. She was supposed to play the lead role, the Kim Novak role in Vertigo. He got pregnant, couldn't do it. I think he was angry at her, so he just kind of like directed her, like, just you owe me one more movie, just do it, I don't care. and so I was attributed her kind of stoicism and her wooden, it's not a wooden performance, but it is a little stiff. And watching it again this time, I kept an eye on her, and I just love watching her, particularly when she's not speaking, when she's just listening, when she's reacting to what's going on, because she is very much an actor's actor in that sense, where when you're not speaking, it's kind of your responsibility, unless you're, you know, doing something else, you know, that to help the scene along. The best thing you can do is look at who's talking, because then the audience is going to look at who's talking, and you're only going to help keep them, you know, interested in what's going on. And you'll get your moment whenever you have your next line, but they'll also probably be watching you because you're listening and because people identify with that passivity, with having to sit there and listen. Like, they're probably watching you right now instead of me. But and especially one thing I have to say about John Gavin, I said kind of like that there's no weak link in this movie, and there's not a weak link. I don't think he's a weak link, but I was watching his performance, and he did the antithesis of what she did. There's the scene where they're talking to the sheriff and his wife in the middle of the night, and Vera Miles is doing her thing as Lila Crane, and I'm totally on board for it this time. I'm just like, look at her listening, and look at her apologizing, looking at her taking the time to like make some sense out of this character without any help from her director. And then I look at John Gavin, and he's completely consumed with himself. He's not listening to anybody. He's just kind of... And then the first line he delivers in a long time, they ask him about going to the Bates place. He's just like, yes, I was standing there at the door. I pounded and I pounded, but she just ignored me. And I'm like, why are you so angry? Like, you don't know this woman. She doesn't owe you anything. Like, what? But this is coming out of nowhere. So I think John Gavin serves his purpose as Sam Loomis. Like, he's nice to look at. He's got that kind of alpha thing going that we need from Sam in order for, you know, that exchange between him and Norman to happen and to make sense, like we talked about. And it does. But as far as a deft hand as an actor, I don't see it as much. I think he was well cast. Period. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Well, I get it. Like you said, like, it's Hitchcock just felt like there's no point. There's no need. We don't need to do anything. They're there to do what they're going to do, you know, as long as they're not pulling focus, because we don't need them to pull focus at this point. But I'm sure, like, if he had the time or the energy or the need to direct him a different way, then he would have. So it didn't really matter. Because even in that scene where they're at the sheriff's house, he's the sheriff, right?
Yeah.
And his wife.
Yes, it is the sheriff.
I'm not particularly interested in what's going on with Sam and Lila. I'm still, my focus is on what about Norman and Mother? Yes. You know, that's the interesting part about it. And, you know, even going back to what we were saying is, like, the Marion story is still continuing with these characters who, like I said, like, they're several steps behind us. We already know what's going on with Marianne, what happened there. So that's why Hitchcock probably knows, like, it's not important. We don't need to get anything from them what's interesting is everything with Norman. And that, after that scene ends, even though there's like enough time passes after they get off the phone with him and they're like still talking to Lila and Sam, we then cut to Norman and he's in the motel office and he hangs up. So we're kind of like, okay, well, now we're not even missing a beat with him. We're actually going back in time by a minute or two to see, like, what was his immediate response after that happened. So
absolutely.
Hitchcock knows. Like, he knew. He's just like, this is where the movie, this is what people are interested in. So as long as he's working his magic on whatever he needs to with Anthony Perkins, then we're golden, because we don't give a shit about Lila and Sam. And it's funny because you in our ranking sort of thing, you actually liked Julianne Moore.
As a final girl. As a final girl, I think I still do. Mm-hmm. Isolated from the rest of the movie that Julianne Moore occupies.
But, I mean, like, because Vera Miles, like, she does have that feistiness to her. Like,
she
does. Just inherent to the character. But I think, I mean, it's been a while since I watched the remake, but I think that, you know, Julianne Moore probably delivers on it a little bit more. Because, I mean, like, that's, you know, just with the way Vera Miles is in Psycho, like the 1961. Like, she is very passive to a point. Like, she wants to take action, but she's not going to do anything unless, like, a man is like, okay, you do this. You know?
Well, also, her strength is basically defined by the men around her, like, by the fact that she's not intimidated by Arbogast the first time she meets him, or the fact that, like, when Sam is, you know, she's the one telling Sam, like, you know, Sam, we have to go up to that house and we have to find out what happened, no matter what we might be afraid of finding or how much it may hurt. And he's just like, I know. But it's all about her coaxing this lummox to, like, accompany her to get the ball rolling.
She would not do any of that on her own.
I do have to say, like, back to the sheriff scene that you were describing, one of the great bait and switches that I absolutely love about that scene is where it ends right before we see Norman hang up the phone when we're still in the house. It's the question the sheriff asks when he says, he's already told them, like, Mrs. Bates has been, dead and buried, you know, like, in Greenlawn Cemetery. And they're just like, oh my gosh, what? And the big question, and they find out about, you know, like, Norman found them in bed together. No, found them together. In bed. And I just love that Lorene Tuttle plays Mrs. Chambers, the sheriff's wife. I adore her. I love watching her during that scene. But at the very end, they're sitting there, and it's just like, so you're saying that Mrs. Bates, well, if that woman up there in that house is Mrs. Bates, who's that woman buried out there in
which is a question
cemetery
that you would never ask, because the question would be, well, then who's the woman in the window? Because we know that Mrs. Bates is in the
But it's such a great, like, okay, so he's buying into the fact that that's Mrs. Bates also, so we all have to buy into it, as opposed to suspecting, like, what's going on up there? It's like, oh, so there must be a case of mistaken identity. Because when I was a boy, I remember the first time I saw that line, I thought, oh, she killed a woman. She killed a woman and probably looked like her, and that was the plan. She'd fake her death so she could kill again. I don't know.
But you mentioned the sheriff's wife, because she was funny, because I loved her response to finding out there was a woman in the house. He's just like, Norman? Or she's like, Norman took a wife? Like,
yes.
Good for him. He's not gay.
Her lines. Every one of her lines is so memorable to me too. Also, just like
the fact that she
periwinkle blue. Yes,
but also the fact that, like, she's the one that, like, picks up the phone for it. Like, he's standing right there, but she picks up the phone.
He
like,
dials.
Operator, get me the Bates Motel. Hands it over to him.
Yes. And then, like I'm saying, like, this is a world where women are defined by the men around them. But I also love the fact that, like, I think her last scene in the movie, when they're out in front of the church, like, they've just gotten out of mass and they're meeting Sam and Lila, who look bereft. Yeah. And she's just like, why don't you come do your detective work at the house? It'll make it nicer.
Yeah.
You too, Sam. You know, she's like Aunt B on the Andy Griffith Show, if anybody gets that reference still. But and also those two characters, I have to say, largely in addition to, like, you know, Hitchcock using, like, the production crew from his television show. Those characters and a lot of the side characters in this movie feel a lot like characters in an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I didn't know that until I binged season one back when Netflix still, or maybe they still do mail DVDs. Yeah. I don't know. But I was still had an account where I was having DVDs mailed to me probably like 10 years ago. And I binged season one. Vera Miles is, I believe, in the pilot, and she's so good. Oh my God. I was like, this is the actress I wish I'd gotten in Psycho. And now I'm nicer. I'm kinder. But, but just watching that show, and then the first time I saw Psycho, kind of on the heels of that show, Psycho largely does feel kind of like a feature-length episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And I don't mean, I mean, of course the cinematography is, you know, like unparalleled and legendary, and, we can't say enough about the score and the screenwriting and everything like that. But there is an essence of, again, the man behind it all, who is like what drives a Hitchcock story being in a way redefined but also fully realized in a cinematic format that I feel I'm really just grasping as an adult now. But as a kid, there was something about this movie that was very comfort food to me, even though there's still moments that unsettle me. There are moments that even I imagined for myself. I remember sometimes when you're a kid and you try to freak yourself out, I used to imagine Norman Bates dressed up as Mother just sitting in her room, her oh my God, her ornate, elaborate, glamorous room, but just sitting there in her chair and just his head kind of moving around like a bird, you know, just like the way birds kind of jerk their heads around. And it used to scare the shit out of me. And even just the haunted feeling, like it's a creepy feeling in the house, whether you know what's going on there or not, because everything is so kind of like of another time. It largely feels like it's a relic of the late 1800s.
Well, yeah, because there's the hands.
Yes,
that, you know, the close up.
Yeah, and the little Cupid arrow, and even just like the
it's structure, all very opulent. Just like,
it is, and very lost. Like, yeah. I mean, it feels like a place that is haunted, and then when you find out what's going on there, it's no less haunted. It's.
I mean, I want to say, I almost wish that we spent more time there, but I feel like that would take away from the mystique of it all. And we do get to, we're there more in the sequels for sure. Here's a question. Oh, yeah. Where do you think Norman sleeps at night? Like, do you think that he actually sleeps in Mother's bed there? I mean, well, I don't know if he would, because that's where the corpse is, but, you know,
but
we see
also
his own room,
sometimes.
Like his childhood room.
Yes, yes.
Do you think that's where he stays?
And it's still lived in. I think still very much lived in. I definitely think he spends at least half his time there.
What do you think? Because Lila opens this book, and we just see her reaction to it, but what do you think's in the book?
Yeah. Okay. Got a couple answers for you, because the immediate answer to your question, when I was a kid, I used to think it was obscene scribbling, which is interesting given what I'm going to say in a minute or so.
Yeah.
What I found out a little later was that books that had pornography in them from, I'd say probably dating back to the late 1800s, did not have any printing on the binding. And if you notice, when she looks at the binding on that book, it's blank, kind of like a journal would be or something like that. But when she opens it up, she does her famous eyebrow raise. And because she does it again later when she finds out, like, when he met your sister, he was touched by her, moved by her, he wanted her.
I remember that.
Aroused by her. And the eyebrows go.
Yeah.
So the eyebrows go a little bit more subtly when she opens up the book. So, as I think it was even illustrated, not illustrated the book, but the point was illustrated to me by Stephen Rebello, who's a huge Psycho historian, who does one of the commentaries, at least on, I think every Blu-ray edition of Psycho that's out. So it's worth listening to. He's great. But, that what she's looking at is pornography. Now, what I like about having read this book, the Robert Bloch one, is that there's a point where she is going through the room. Lila is in Norman's house, and she finds these little sketchbooks, and they're overtly sexual, but also overtly destructive. Like, they're female bodies, but they're female bodies being sawed in half, or female bodies, you know, being stripped of their skin, or female bodies with, you know, vaginas where they don't belong. Like, I mean, it's very, like, you know, the kind of thing that in the 1950s, which is when the book takes place, you would have been really, really scared if you found it in an old alcoholic reprobate's room. So, I love that. Finding out that in the book, I was just kind of like, I was right, kind of, about, like, obscene scribblings and things like that. That's the feeling I got, like, that's what she saw.
But now I'm curious, you know, it's, of like, what if they showed something in the remake of...
Oh, it was so much more pedestrian. She finds a dirty magazine.
Okay, so that's what I thought. It was just, like, Penthouse or something like that.
No, yeah, so less interesting. I know, it's gross. But, like, I mean, gross, not because
it's not even gross. Pornography. It's, just, like,
it's not gross. No, but I mean, it's gross because it's predictable and because it's so pedestrian. And there's nothing pedestrian about Norman Bates. Yeah.
No, go on with your also first.
Just the fact that there was another thing that I noticed this time, that I always noticed, but I just wanted to articulate it, that's still in keeping with this, like, putting you in their shoes thing that happens to Lila just after this moment when she sees Norman coming up the steps, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
And she runs over to the cellar door underneath the stairs, and we're all, don't go down the cellar! But before that, she's kind of clutching the little railing that's guarding the cellar door. And what I love about it is before he looks in her direction, her fingers are visible. And before she can't even see him, really. But before he looks down at the railing, she moves her fingers away. She's like, oh, fuck, he could see my fingers. And it gave me tension this time. I was just like, would you just get your hands off? He's going to see you. And how many times have I seen this movie? But there are so many things like that littered throughout this movie that just make you go, no, bitch! You know, to man or woman or other. What were you going to say?
Well, I wanted to ask you because, okay, what... other than, you know, the hip swivel that you mentioned of him going up the stairs, what other moments do you attribute to kind of like his transformation into Mother? Because there's, you know, the last time we see him before... You know, we cut to Marion back in the motel room before the whole shower scene. He goes into the house and he sits down at the kitchen table and then he kind of just like looks up and then it cuts. But, you know, before that he's already exhibiting strange behavior. And well, no, okay. In particular, maybe not strange for Norman, but, like, he's got the peephole behind the picture in his parlor where he can spy on her and, you know, getting undressed. And then even after that, he goes into the office and looks at the registry, the check-in, and looks at her name because she, you know, he's just like, good night, miss, and she says Crane. But in the thing, she wrote Marie Samuels. So it almost like made me think, like, is it like, can this be Mother at this point? Or is this like Norman and like it's showing like premeditation? Because it's almost like here's a woman who's like clearly nobody knows she's here. She's on the run. She's using a fake identity.
Right.
So it makes me question like how much of Mother is, you know, actually Norman and like what is he cognizant of when he does commit murders, because it was almost like setting it up for her, you know, even if Mother does take over.
I'm really glad you asked me this question because I have a very severe opinion on it. Let me set it up. I was watching 78 50 2. Now I can't remember the name of the movie, but the documentary where they're talking about the shower scene. And Daniel Noah, the producer, is watching the scene with Elijah Wood and somebody else on a couch. They're watching the parlor scene. And she says, wouldn't it be better if you put her someplace? And he does the lean forward and says, you mean an institution? A madhouse? And Daniel Noah turns to Elijah Wood and says, like, that must have been the moment when he decided he was going to kill her. And Elijah Wood's like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, fuck you. No, he didn't kill her. Mother did. Within the lore of Psycho, as it is explicitly pointed out by the therapist at the end, or the psychologist, what have you, he was never all Norman, but he was often only Mother. Now, when these episodes would end, Norman woke up as if from a deep sleep. So I don't think Norman has any hand in the calculation of Mother's comings and goings. I think it's much more in the nature, because if he was, what is that? Mother! Oh God, Mother! Blood! Blood! Like, you know? Where's that coming from? Like, I didn't know you were going to kill again, even though I helped you set it up. Yeah. I think what's happening in that moment, because there's a lot of questions here, what's happening in that moment when he looks at the registry to see Marie Samuels and everything after he heard her name Crane, I think he's got this smug smile on his face, but I think it's because he's just learned that she's more like him, because he does know he's sick. Doesn't mean he's conscious while Mother is present. But, you know, he's the one who's waking up. He's the one who's, you know, moving the dead body around. He's the one who knows nobody can go up there and see, because then they're going to find out and then all the truth is going to come out. But never underestimate the power of denial. You can live happily in denial for eons. So anyway, but he sees Marie Samuels after she tells him her name is Marion Crane, and he knows she's not presenting her full true self to him the same way he didn't present his full true self to her. Mm-hmm. She thinks he's just this mild-mannered, sweet guy, and he's about to look at her through a wall and watch her change. And so I think that's just what that moment is about. It's just kind of like, God, crazy world. So many people pass by here. It's so interesting. You know, nobody's really any different, and everybody's pretending they're somebody else. Everybody's got their own little secret that they're hiding. That's what I've got from that. But another moment that I do see Mother in definitely is when Arbogast has already been killed, and John Gavin, Sam Loomis, has driven to the motel, and he's just screaming, Arbogast! And we see Norman leering at the swamp, and he just slowly turns his head as the shot, like, cranes in toward him. And there's this darkness, these shadows that have fallen in his face. And I always felt like that was Mother. Even though he wasn't dressed up like her, sometimes she just took over. Yeah.
The moment when he does, when he sits down at the table in a very Anthony Perkins kind of way, like, you know, what you would expect from Norman, but then has that sort of like looks up, like that's what I attributed, like, oh, there's Mother. She's now at that point, she's now going up the stairs, she's putting on her wig and dress, getting the knife, and then she's going down to the motel.
Right. I think that moment that I mentioned in the parlor scene is significant, not because it's when Norman decides he's going to kill Marion, but it's significant because I think that's when Mother starts to eclipse him a little bit. Yeah. But it also calls into question, like, if there is some of Norman speaking right now also, because he's very defensive of his mother, but Mother's also very defensive about being, you know, the laughing and the tears and the cruel eyes studying you. It makes you wonder who spent time in a facility. It was either her or it was him or it was both of them, not together, but I mean, like, maybe it was her at one point and he had to go visit her. Mm-hmm. And then at another point, maybe he got locked up and everything like that. But another thing I love about the movie that just gets more and more as I get older is the ambiguity of what's true, even as we perceive it, because even when the therapist at the very end is discussing how he got the story from Mother, he got the story from Norman's version of Norma Bates. We don't know if everything that we learn about Norma Bates in this movie is true, because Norman may not be the most reliable narrator. And I'm not going to make this pod about it, but I did want to touch on Bates Motel, the series. One of the things that I really appreciated about that series, they totally take that into account. Like, it's almost as if somebody asked, the conceit of it is, well, what if Norman wasn't a reliable narrator? What if his mother wasn't, not anything like that, but what if she wasn't exactly who we think Norman thinks she was, you know, like that kind of thing.
There's also the fact that like, we don't know that what mother at this point in like quotation fingers is telling the psychologist, because even when they're like, he feels a chill, we're going to bring him a blanket, and you have that ends there of just like, you know, I'm not even going to swat that fly. And, you know, it's just like, it's almost like in that part of his psyche, which is mother at that point, is telling the psychologist what the psychologist is going to tell everybody else in that room. And who knows if what that story is, you know, if the psychologist is even like reading it properly or just taking it at face value of what, you know, mother is saying and then repeating that. So there could be lies upon lies upon lies. We don't even know who Norman really is. And he mentions that, because the psychologist does say something about, well, mother, you know, he created this thing where, you know, he was jealous of his mother, but in his mind, mother was just as jealous of him. So it's just like, in that's why whatever that thing you're talking about with Elijah Wood, where whoever said this,
and
is
Daniel
what it
Noah,
is.
Yeah,
like, I don't buy that, because mother, as it were, wouldn't feel threatened by, even if this, if what they're saying at the end is true, or what mother is telling the psychologist is true, she wouldn't be threatened by Marion Crane for suggesting, why don't you put her in a home, but would be threatened by her because it's like, here's this beautiful woman that her son is now leering at and, you know, fantasizing about. That's the version of mother that mother tells the psychologist. So there's just like, it's so confusing. Like, you don't know what's true by the end. All you know is that there's like a lot of mental damage going on inside this person's head, and you don't know which voice is actually the truth.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite ways to structure a film, because there is so much more movie going on behind the scenes, like what we don't see and what we don't even hear. Like, it's everything is kind of like about gaining some kind of secondhand what's the word I'm looking for? Like gaining access secondhand, like not gaining direct access, even when you're in the direct company of people, because we don't know who we can trust, and we don't know what is the truth, and we don't know, the thing that's most unnerving about it is the film is largely about like kind of like looking beneath and beyond facades, yet we're left with more questions at the end of the movie, I feel, than with answers. Like, even with Alfred Hitchcock originally didn't want the psychotherapist to be just sitting there proselytizing about like what went on and everything like that. He called it a hat grapper moment, that people would have been like, the movie's over, we already know Norman's a killer, all right, bye. And Joseph Stefano had to just let him know, I don't think anybody's going to be grabbing their hats at this point, because we just showed them that this guy dresses up as his mother and kills women, and anybody who gets too close to the truth, I think they're going to need some kind of explanation. They're going to need something from us. So he let him keep it in. And I'm really, really glad he did. But I'm also really, really glad that we went back to the car being pulled out of the mud at the very end, because it brings back the the way Joseph Stefano put it, he said that brings you back the person you lost with Marion. Mm-hmm. But for me, it also brings us back to just the muck and the mire that we've kind of like been occupying this whole time in the most glamorous way possible. There are movies since Psycho that have depicted being in the muck and the mire, you know, the silverfish infested couch cushions of, you know, the devil's parlor. But this one, because we see a toilet for the first time, because we see the toilet flushed for the first time, because we don't see Janet Leigh in a slip, we see her in a bra, even though it was constructed largely to conceal any cleavage or anything like that, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's still 1960s version of, you know, like, the most exposure, I guess, a daily life, you know, a daily life as at least as an American, I guess. You could experience, you know, like there's
like, no, just no like how much they could push the envelope without, getting in trouble.
We'll exactly.
Say. Cause you know, that's even like going back to Lila's raised eyebrow of looking in the book. And I always see the ending as, cause I mean, like it's bookended with the story of Marion. So that's why, you know, it goes back to the car there, but also by the time it goes back to the car, that whole story is so mundane that it's kind of like almost, hey, remember that? That doesn't matter anymore. But here we're just showing that there's a resolution to it. So
I also think about those two other missing girls. I think about the two other missing girls and I'm like, are they underneath there too? Are those?
Oh, they're going to drain that swamp and they're going to find treasures upon treasures of, there are more than $40,000 in just, all these cars. Yeah. And shit. is there anything else you wanted to touch upon?
I mean, nothing, I could talk about this movie forever, but I know, like, but like, I mean, nothing in particular. I'm pretty satisfied. I'm sure it'll come up if we ever do the sequels or the remake or Bates Motel or anything. Yeah, it'll come up. All
right. Well, let's get to the cherry picker.
It's not like they killed people. On purpose.
All right. You got a cherry on top?
Oh.
Can only be one.
I mean, fuck. God. I mean, fuck.
I don't know how how is it anyone other than Norman Bates?
I know.
You're gonna say Janet Leigh.
But also because they're so on par with each other. Like that's one thing I didn't really get to spell it as that. Like I said it, but that I have that parlor scene memorized. I've performed it many times in rainy nights with friends and creeped them out. I've creeped out guys on dates, you know, when the conversation has just run out. So I just do the parlor scene for them. and anyway, it doesn't usually creep them out though. It actually kind of works in my favor because it's, you know, very low. Anyway, but I think she's definitely deserves, you know, a shout out and a mention. Like, she's a contender for sure. Yeah. I agree, though. Like, Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates. Come on.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry for such a disappointing cherry on top, you know?
No, it's the epitome. It's wonderful.
All right. Now, cherry picker. Last week, we asked you who deserves to die the most in Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. I said Jordan, or actually I nominated Jordan. You nominated David across Patreon, Instagram, and YouTube. The vote was 151 for Jordan versus 110 for David.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Actually, and the Instagram poll actually went more towards the side of David. So,
okay. See,
Instagram's always different. It's always different.
Yeah. A lot of hate for Jordan, though. Wow.
Well, let's see what the hate is specifically.
Yeah, I'm curious. Because
I'm going to read some comments here. Shiro the Idiot says, Jordan, but also you can't blame her. Because she kind of has a split personality. I actually feel bad for David. Like, if you actually know why he did that thing, it's not what you think. Did you get the sense of a split personality from Jordan?
not a split personality so much as what I call, and what it is called, a duplicitous nature. Like, yeah. I think she's two-faced. I don't think she's got, you know, dissociative personality disorder.
Yeah. Slasher in Suits says, Jordan, she actually stirred the pot and was flirting with B, which wasn't her girl.
Okay.
Thomas Baker says, David only did what he did because Alice's boyfriend showed off. Also, Jordan was really terrible too. So I guess that's a vote for Jordan?
I think so too. It sounds, that's really confusing.
I look at the first word and if it's like the name, let's be like David. And I'm like, oh wait, no. But in this case, Grant Dempsey does say David! ! Oh my God, insufferable jackass. Wish he could have just tried the trick a few nights later so that no one else would have had to die.
Yay!
Dayman Fighter of the Nightman says, haven't seen it yet. Gonna try to catch it over the weekend. Well, I hope you got the opportunity.
Yeah.
Neon Icon says, I don't know, haven't seen it. I'm going to go with Eddie's pick, though, because I've come to like him more than Zach. Nothing against Zach. I just like Eddie more.
What?
Well, fuck you.
Oh, my God. That was blunt.
That was very blunt. And that also clears up your theory that I'm the favorite, but, you know, just leave
did
it at that.
Did I say that? Okay, did I ever say that? Okay, sure, maybe I did.
No, I think a while ago, because you were, what was it? We were going to do the cherry picker. I was going to nominate. It was basically like two characters that were the same thing. They might have been like, oh, it was in the Us episode, because we're just like, how about the twins?
Right.
And we don't even know their name. And he's like, that's the perfect way to find out if there's a...
if there's favoritism.
Favoritism. Yeah. By picking two characters who are exactly the same.
I stand by that.
Yeah, but apparently we know where Neon Icon would vote in that case. And then somebody says, Jordan. That's it.
Cool.
So... I get first dibs.
Go for it. Who you choose?
I'm sorry that you didn't get first dibs for your favorite.
That's all right.
Scary movie, but I'm gonna, or maybe favorite movie, but I'm gonna go with Arbogast, because not that I think he's a shitty person or anything. But this goes back to what we were saying, is because like I empathize with Norman during his scenes. It's just like. Who is this fucking asshole that's really good at his job and, like, getting the truth out of Norman, who just can't keep a lie going to save his life and is stumbling over it. And it's just, like, I hate him so much in the moment because he's, like, you know, he's so necessary and I like what he does for the movie. But, who else am I going to hate in this movie? I don't know. Maybe you'll be able to tell us. So who do you nominate?
Well, I can't hate Arbogast because, number one, I love Martin Balsam as an actor, and I love watching him work off of Tony Perkins, especially now that there's no more Janet Leigh in the movie. So it's like, I need somebody who can...
Look, you know, we don't necessarily have to hate our nomination.
No, of course, just, of course.
Who deserves to die? I love people who do deserve to die. So I'm just saying him because he was nosy. He got in there. You deserve to die.
Okay. Wow. Okay, so my choice, I have to choose between two. I'm gonna go with... Fuck me. Who do I hate more? Okay, we have more screen time with this guy, so I'm gonna say Tom Cassidy, the man in the cowboy hat who rightfully owner of the $40,000. Okay. I don't like him because he's exactly the kind of person I hate whenever I'm at my place of work, wherever I've worked throughout the years. There's always that person who's got all the money in the world, throws their weight around, tries to make jokes with you when you're trying to work, sexually harasses one woman in the room and acts like it's supposed to be some kind of compliment. and makes horrible jokes and makes everybody uncomfortable. And then I get this. This is another, actually, I didn't get to mention this. This is another point of entry for me into the movie. When Janet Leigh is driving and she's imagining the conversations that are happening, like come Monday when people show up to work and realize the money's missing and so is she. And he's just like, hot creepers, she sat there and watched me dole it out, like planning and even flirting with me. And that that smirk on her face, just kind of like, yeah, fuck you, fucker. You probably thought I was, you probably would think I was flirting with you, you gross old blah, 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 blah. But now I've got your money, bitch, and I'm living it up with the hottest man in Fairvale, so take that. But, so, yeah, I choose him.
Your headcanon is just so funny sometimes.
It's, I've seen the movie way too much.
But he also says something,
all headcanon now.
He says something else about her, like, flesh or something.
Oh, and if any of it's missing, I'll replace it with her fine, soft flesh. Now, mind you, none of this stuff is actually said by him. But the fact
it's just
that
in
she's
her imagination.
Yeah, the fact that she's imagining him say it, I'm like, I would have imagined the exact same thing. And you know what? I would have felt just as gratified that he
So maybe it's not even, what's the character's name?
His name is Tom Cassidy.
So maybe it's not Tom Cassidy, but just like, you're nominating Marion's like imagination of Tom Cassidy.
No, because I don't like him either when he first comes in, and the way he's like leering at her and leaning on her desk and shit.
Yeah,
I mean, she even kind of takes offense before he even does any of that, when he's just kind of like, it's a few days, my sweet little girl. And she
and you just
like,
know
me?
That his breath smelled awful too.
And I just
and it
love
all
Yeah, no, he's terrible. Yeah. And then it's like, speaking of that, where's that bottle you had in your desk? Oh, ho, 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 ho. You know, sometimes I can't keep my mouth shut. And Janet Leigh does that great take to him where she's not saying anything, but her eyes are. And she's just kind of like, I'd really like to be around when you can keep your mouth shut. I'll believe it when I see it, kind of thing.
To me, it looked more like, okay, like, move along.
Exactly.
We're done here.
Same thing, all of it. Look, the looks are.
Yeah.
One look is worth a thousand words, and especially when it's Janet Leigh doing the looking.
Yeah, totally. Who is the other?
He tells her, "You need a weekend in Las Vegas." It's like, fuck no, bye. You know.
Well, they. Like, but that, there was a line that was. That was taken out where she's like, I'm spending the weekend in bed. And then he said something to the effect of you probably know what it was.
That actually haven't heard. That's
well, no, they used it. They it was left in the remake.
Oh, okay. I don't
we'll
remember.
Have to, okay. Well, if
when
and when we ever
remake,
get to
we'll
that,
address that.
But something about like the best playground in the world or something. Speaking of Vegas.
That,
she said something like, I'm just going to like go to my bedroom or spend the weekend in my bedroom.
Yeah.
He said something
in
about
bed,
like,
yeah.
It's another playground. But who was the other? Just for curiosity's sake, you said you were choosing between two. So who was the other
Well,
one?
Just because I'm worried people might not remember him as much as I do, but I hate him just as much. Deputy District Attorney Alan Dietz, played by Francis DeSales. He's basically the man, I hate him for one reason. He's the man who, when John Gavin asks with disgust at the end of the movie, why was he dressed like that? And he just goes, he's a transvestite with all the authority of a mediocre white man. Like, I can't. He has no insight to the situation, but he's declaring that's the reason. I know why, because there's only one reason a man would ever put on a woman's gear, you know? And I, for that reason, I think he's everything that's wrong with the world. But I don't know if he's going to, like, you know, trigger as many people as Tom Cassidy.
Yeah,
But I do hate them both, and I like I said, the only reason I chose Tom Cassidy is he gets more screen time. He does, anyway, vomit.
He's also the inciting reason for Arbogast to be there. He hired him, so
Ooh.
There you go.
So what? I like our
podcast. That could have been a defense. It's just like that you always go, like, this is the one that started it all.
He's the one who started it all. If he didn't carry around $40,000 in cash, Marion never would have been tempted. And no, but that's total. Like, he's still a victim. That's victim shaming. Yeah. I don't like that. But
okay.
But I do kind of agree.
Anyway, those are your nominations. You can vote for Detective Milton Arbogast or Tom Cassidy. And you can do that on Patreon, on Instagram, or YouTube.
Yeah.
Speaking of Patreon, I would like to welcome a few new Patreon supporters. So give it up for Shannon L.M., Stephen Williamson, Jesse Williams, and Alex Stone. Yay. Welcome aboard.
And, thanks, everybody.
Also, speaking of Patreon, this week we've got our Buffy Season 2 Cherry Picker After Dark episode coming out. So that will be us discussing, analyzing, and ranking all 22 episodes of Buffy Season 2. The first season is also there now. So if you subscribe to Patreon at the Freddy Krueger tier, you'll have all of that. And we plan on going through the entire series. But you'll, you know, have access to all the other episodes, including the final girl ranking that you mentioned earlier with Lila Crane.
The Lila Cranes.
Yeah.
The dueling Lila Cranes.
The dueling. Yeah. But dueling against like 86 other final girls. But
exactly.
Yeah. You can find that under my name, Zach Cherry, on Patreon. If you would like to follow us on social media.
What happened to you?
This is a lot to remember. Just
I know.
Instagram officially is at the Cherry Picker Pod. If you are new to the Cherry Picker and you're listening to this, you can also watch us on YouTube. So head over there and subscribe to our channel, The Cherry Picker. And if you are watching us on YouTube and you want to listen to us, the podcast is also available in all streaming platforms. So the RSS feed link is in the descriptions down below. Where can they find you on social media, Eduardo?
Edward is truth. One word on not all platforms, because I'm only on two, really. YouTube and Instagram. You can watch me react to movies on the YouTube, Edward is truth. And on Instagram, you can watch everything else.
Yes, because there's a lot of videos on Instagram now.
Yeah, right.
TikTok thing. Yeah, I don't get it anymore.
I'm never gonna do the TikTok thing. I don't think.
I don't know. How do you do it? I don't understand. I've tried to.
You point to the screen and you edit it, and you put little factoids that you wanna, like, you know.
It might be a little more nuanced than that, but you're right. It is. It's very simple. I mean, for whoever's cracked it, good for you. But
right.
I don't have TikTok. I'm on Instagram at RetroBitchface. I've got a Twitter. It's at ZachCherry8. And I've also got my main YouTube channel, Zach Cherry. So find us there. What do we got going on next week?
I'm glad you asked, because I totally remember. But how about you? I always say it. How about you for a change, Zach Cherry? Tell us what's going on next week.
Well, next week we're going to kill Halloweens.
Yes! Halloween kills, kids. I see how I slapped in the softball there.
Yeah, it's Halloween kills, because we are working our way up to Halloween Ends, which is releasing next month. So we already did Halloween 2018. You can check that out. It's a few episodes back. And just to keep up with tradition, we are going to cover all three of the new Blumhouse trilogy Halloweens this year. Yeah. So this month is Halloween Kills. Next month is Halloween Ends. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And we will be right back.